With that, we'll call upon our brother Jim to give us his last study for the day, the King of the North and the King of the South in history and prophecy of the future.
Well, thanks, Brother Dave, and good evening again, brethren and young men. We've come to our final session for the day. It's been a long day, but I don't feel as exhausted as I thought I would feel because you did most of the work this afternoon. Thank you for that. I think it was a useful exercise to do, wasn't it, on Psalm 83, and I hope we can get an end result out of that that will be useful for other people as well. Daniel chapter 11, of course, is a major, it's a large chapter in the prophecy of Daniel. It's part of the last three chapters, chapters 10, 11 and 12, which are all part of the same discourse given to Daniel by the angel in the last year of his life. We read in Daniel chapter 10, by the way, in verse 1, it says, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed unto Daniel. And so an angel comes to him to reveal this latter portion of the prophecy from chapter 10 through to the end of chapter 12. Now it says the third year of Cyrus, whereas in chapter 1 and verse 21 of Daniel, we read that Daniel died in the first year of Cyrus. So you've got to reconcile that. In actual fact, what we have here is the first year of Cyrus's sole reign in chapter 1. This is the third year from his conquering of the city of Babylon. And what he did when he conquered Babylon is that he put Darius the Mede on the throne, who would rule for him, and then he went on with his conquests. And so in actual fact, he was the king, but he wasn't there to rule. Darius ruled for him. So it's actually the first year of Cyrus's sole reign that this, and it's the year of Daniel's death that this is revealed to him. So when you come to chapter 11, verses 1 to 4 provide the transition from the Medo-Persian Empire to the Grecian Empire, and its break up into four parts after the death of Alexander the Great. Verses 5 to 35 then deal with the history of the interaction and conflict between the two principal sections of the Greek Empire for 200 years, in which the glorious land, in other words, the land of Israel, was desecrated because it was used as a battleground between the Seleucid kingdom, which was called here the King of the North, and the Ptolemaic kingdom in Egypt, called the King of the South. So we want to actually explore what part these two kingdoms, the King of the North and the King of the South, played in history briefly, and most importantly, this is why we read the last few verses of Daniel chapter 11, what part they play today and tomorrow in the events of Armageddon and beyond. Okay, so that's where we're heading in this particular study. So I'm going to start with the simple and the straightforward, and then we're going to go up the ladder a little bit. We're going to raise the bar as we proceed. It won't be too high, though, because we've had a tough day, a long day, and so I'm going to be easy on you. I'll go easy on you. So we ask this question. What is required for latter-day successors of the King of the North and the King of the South to be called by those names? So what attributes do you have to have in order to be called by these two names or titles, King of the North, King of the South? Well, let's go back in history. The Greeks were foreign occupiers of historical lands that had been essential parts of previous empires. So that's the first point we know. They were foreign occupiers. When Britain took control of Egypt in 1882 and did not leave until 1954, it became the King of the South for that period. And while Britain was the King of the South, it fulfilled Daniel chapter 11, verse 40, part A. All right? So let's have a look at Daniel 11, verse 40, part A. It says this, and at the time of the end, which tells you something about the way Yahweh sees time, because we're actually talking here in the first part of this verse about 1917. Now, you and I wouldn't have called that the time of the end, would we? But God does, because you see he's been working out his plan progressively from all of that time right down to our day, all right? Time doesn't mean anything to God. I mean, it's not like you and I. We are restricted by time. He's not restricted by time. So he sees the big picture. This is the time of the end. It says, shall the king of the south push at him? What do you have to be? You have to be a foreign occupier of the land of Egypt to be called the King of the South. Because the entire history that we read in this chapter, chapter 11, is about the conflict between the kingdom of the Ptolemies in Egypt and the kingdom of the Seleucids in Syria, right out across to the river Indus. Okay? And we're going to have a look at the picture, at the map in a moment. We'll see where they were, and I think you all know it anyway. But we'll have a look at the map, and we'll see the history of this. And they had continual conflict between themselves, as this record of Daniel 11 tells us. So accurate, by the way, that the higher critics said it was not possible for Daniel to have written this at the time that he alleged to have written it before it actually happened. It had to be written after the event. It is so accurate in its history. And this precise details given. Well, the only problem they've got is, of course, that Daniel was actually translated into Greek in 196 BC by one of the Ptolemies. Okay, so this is before, you know, this is before the events actually fully played themselves out. And so Daniel was written well before the event, and the accuracy is awesome. So here you've got these two kingdoms, the Seleucid and the Ptolemaic, fighting. Well, of course, what was their battleground? The battleground is the glorious land, which was like the meat in the sandwich, wasn't it? So when they came from the north to the south, it was Israel that they trod through, and that was that's why, of course, it's so important. So let's have a look then at what we've got here. We've got the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. Now, the first thing you need to establish here is who the him is here, don't you? And you get your answer from the context. And you go back to verse 36 to 39, the preceding verses, it tells you who the him is. So let's go back to verse 36. And the king, what king? The king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvellous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the gods of his fathers, nor the desire of women, which gives you a clue, because this is about the, you know, the Catholic religion, isn't it? The desire of women. Nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. This is the papal system, and magnifies itself above all. And goes on to talk about, verse 38, but in his estate shall he honour the god of forces. Now your margin might have what mine has got, and Brother Thomas that describes this in Elpis Israel and exposition of Daniel as the Mohuzim Bazaars. Now, the Mohuzim Bazaars, of course, is the Catholic churches where they used to sell relics. They'd sell relics of the cross, or relics of this, or bones of so-called saints, you know, and they would actually sell these off, right? They were like a bazaar, like a market. And so this is about the Catholic religion and its horrible practices. And a god whom his fathers knew not shall he honour with gold and with silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Now, if you want to actually follow this up, just take a note of Eureka Volume 4. This is the Logos edition of Eureka. Eureka Volume 4, pages 286 to 288. You can actually read up on all of this in the Mohuzim Bazaar. So what we have here, of course, is a reference to what we've read in Chapter 8. This is the Catholic system installed in the East, in Constantinople, okay? This is what it's referring to. Because, as we know, ultimately, in 324, the Roman government was moved there, and Constantinople, originally Byzantium, was, of course, that area, the kingdom of Pergamum, was bequeathed to the Romans in BC 133, and ultimately became a centre of their religion. So, as Brother Thomas points out, the king that's referred to in verse 36 here is actually the little horn of the goat of Daniel chapter 8 and verse 9. Not a bad idea to have a little note in your margin alongside of verses 36 to 39 that this is a reference to the little horn of the goat of Daniel chapter 8 and verse 9. This is the kingdom bequeathed to the Romans, and they then progressively build up their power in the east, and ultimately Constantinople becomes the capital. And so, as Brother Thomas points out, whoever is the occupier of Constantinople, whether it be pagan Romans, Christian Romans, Muslims, which is Muslim today, isn't it? Yeah, because it's ruled by Erdogan, who's essentially a Muslim. Okay, it doesn't matter who they are, whether they're Russians, because they're going to take this place over. It doesn't matter who they are. Whoever occupies Constantinople is the little horn of the goat. Okay? And that's, it's essential to understand that, because the context is telling us that the hymn of verse 40 is the occupier of Constantinople. Well, what year is this? Well, we believe it's 1917. Who was the occupier of Constantinople in 1917? The Turks. And they were the occupiers of Palestine. And God wants the Turks out of Palestine because he wants the nation of Israel to be formed in the land of Palestine. So what does he do? He's got the British, who are the controllers, the foreign occupiers of Egypt. They're the king of the south, therefore. Historically, that's what you had to be, a foreign occupier of Egypt. And what do? Well, they used Australian and New Zealand troops, and they moved up, foolishly attacked Gaza, lost 10,000 men, then went around to Beersheba. Almost, it was a disaster, because on the very last day when their animals were about to perish, they did the charge to Beersheba, which you never did. You always got off your horse, but they were too late. So they charged to Beersheba, took the town of Beersheba, and that was the end of the Turks. Ultimately, the Turks were pushed out of Palestine. And on the 11th of December, Allenby got off his horse and walked into Jerusalem, and the Turks are gone, all right? So this is what it means. At the time of the end shall the king of the south, the foreign occupier of Egypt, shall push at him, the occupier of Constantinople, which were the Turks. Okay? Right. When Russia takes control of the region from Syria to Pakistan, which was the old Seleucid kingdom area, it will become the king of the north to fulfill Daniel 11:40, part B. So this is yet still future. And we read part B, and the king of the north shall come against him. Who's the him? Well, him is the occupier, the king of verse 36. The him is the power occupying Constantinople. The king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. So what we have here is Russia taking control of Constantinople and making it the base of their operations to head down into the Middle East, to go into Egypt, as Daniel chapter 11 says, and they'll be drawn back to Israel. Got a picture? All right. So this is why the king of the north and the king of the south are very important. Now, of course, Russia isn't in control today of the Seleucid kingdom, are they? They're just on the western border of it. They just happen to be in Syria, in Latakia and Tartus and other parts of Syria. It's the beginning of the fulfillment of this prophecy, because they will take it before they take Constantinople. So we'll get to that. But I'm going to get back to the simple stuff, okay? So let's go back to the simple stuff. Let's come back to the beginning of Daniel chapter 11. You can see where we're heading. Daniel 11. Now, what you see on the screen here is actually from a very old Christadelphian writing. Okay, so I'm just going to put it up there. It's quite straightforward. It explains the first few verses of Daniel chapter 11. Verse 1, introductory. The prophecy begins in verse 2. And it reads, doesn't it? In Daniel chapter 11, behold, there shall, spoken of the third year of Cyrus, that is the first year of his sole reign, B.C. 536, by the way, it was. That was the year of the decree of Cyrus. There shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength through his riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. Fulfillment? After Cyrus, there reigned three Persian emperors, Cambyses, Smerdis, and Darius. Then came Xerxes, notorious in history as the richest of all the Persian monarchs, the leading event of whose reign was the fitting out of an immense naval and military expedition against Greece in 380 BC. This was the beginning of a war which lasted through several Persian reigns and ended in Persian overthrow. He comes to verse 3. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Fulfillment? On the Greek side, there rose up Alexander the Great, who had trampled down the power of Persia and established an immense empire reaching as far as India, which he ruled with despotic authority. Verse 4. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided towards the four winds of heaven, not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion, which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up for others besides those. Fulfillment. When Alexander had finished the conquest of India and returned to Babylon, he came to a premature end, aged 32 years and 8 months, at a feast. He probably also died of the puncture of his lungs and all sorts of other fevers that were around. And his empire, after a regency of 13 years, was partitioned among his 4 generals, Ptolemy Soter, he was the one that took over Egypt, Seleucus, who took over the region from Syria across to the Indus River in Pakistan, Lysimachus and Cassander, who were over in Pergamum and in Macedonia, none of whom were family relations of Alexander. Of these, Ptolemy Soter became king of Egypt, or king of the south, in relation to Palestine at that time, and Seleucus, king of Syria, or king of the north. Okay? Now, that's a pretty simple summary, isn't it? It's a pretty good summary, too, by the way, the first few verses of Daniel chapter 11. It's this transition from the Medo-Persian Empire to the Grecian Empire, and that Grecian Empire is divided up into 4 parts, and 2 principal parts play through the rest of this chapter. The major portion of the chapter is devoted to their warfare and their relationship right down to the time when the Grecian Empire came to an end. But it has this wonderful latter-day relevance. From verses 5 to 35, the history of conflict between the king of the south and the king of the north between 323 BC and 133, when the Romans inherited Pergamum, this saw the development of the little horn of the goat of Daniel chapter 8, verses 8 to 10. Now, we're all familiar with what Daniel 11, 40, 45 speaks about. It speaks about Armageddon, all nations being drawn to Jerusalem, and of course they're drawn from the 4 points of the compass, the Confederates with Gog, and portion of that is over here in the east, all right, the countries of Syria, Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan, and portion of Pakistan will be part of the Gogian Confederacy. Now it's that that I want to enter into. I want to just, this is where I'm going to step it up just a couple of levels, okay, we'll raise the bar a little bit here. Some of you have heard this before, so it's not going to be new to some of you. But we're going to have a look at the scriptural position in relation to this, because there are 3 passages that speak about a Russian takeover of this portion from Syria right across to the Indus River. 3 passages, okay? Daniel chapter 11, verse 40 is one of them, but there's 2 others. And the first of those is Ezekiel chapter 38 and verses 5 to 7, in particular, the very first word of verse 5, the name Persia. So when you read Persia, what do you think of? Iran. Persia equals, that's how our mind thinks, isn't it? Not how Ezekiel's mind thought. Right? You look at this from the perspective of the prophet who wrote this. What was Persia like when he wrote this about circa 600 BC? Well, let's take a look at a map. All right. Now this map, you'll see, those of you who've got a pair of binoculars at the back, will see the red line is the Persian Empire 500 BC. Okay, so this is the time, post-Cyrus time. The dotted line, the Median Empire, 625 to 550 BC. Now, bearing in mind that the Medo-Persians took Babylon in 539 BC. Okay? So this is a very relevant map. See this purple line around here? And it goes up above Babylon? This was the Babylonian Empire in 539. This was the Median Empire. We've painted the Medo-Persian Empire, okay? It's considerably larger, isn't it? It goes from over here, eastern Turkey and Syria, right across to almost to India, all right, to the Indus River. That was the Persia that Ezekiel knew. Right, so when you think of Persia here in Ezekiel 38, don't think Iran. It includes Iran, but it's a much bigger territory than that. So when you read this verse, that's what we have in mind, that entire region. So there's verse 1. That's the first passage that demonstrates this. And the second one is Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7. Okay? Now remember I made the point that there's a part of this verse that hasn't yet been fulfilled? It's in the green there. So here's the fourth beast. This is the Roman Empire of old. Dreadful, terrible, strong, exceeding, great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces. All historical. It did that in history. It was diverse from all the beasts that preceded it. Yet, true to history. But this green section here, and stamp the residue with the feet of it, has never been done. It was never done by the Roman Empire of old. Which means, of course, that someone's got to do it in the future. And that's critical, because you see, this is the same message that we read in Ezekiel 38, verse 5, because the territory here, as you'll see in a minute, is what's called the residue. Well, the residue of what? Well, the residue of the previous empires. And you know what happened in history? There's Babylon in the brown you see on the screen here. Relatively small, really. Along comes the Medo-Persian bear. He's got three ribs in his mouth because of three parts of the empire. He devours the territory of the Babylonians. Along comes Alexander in this map over here. He comes from Macedonia in the west. He comes right over to the Indus River in the east. He devours the territory of the Medo-Persian Empire. Then along comes the Roman Empire. Well, how far did they get to the east? The furthest they got to the east was the head of the Persian Gulf under Trajan. Couldn't hold it. The Parthians were too strong. So when Hadrian came to power in 118 AD, he drew a line in the sand and said, pulling all our forces back to a line of forts that they built right down through modern Jordan today. You can go and stand in them because they're still there. All right, a line of forts. That became the eastern border of the Roman Empire for the rest of its history. What's the residue then? The residue is the parts of the previous empires that the Roman Empire in its history of old never conquered. So what are they? A portion of Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, half of Pakistan, up to the Indus River. In history, they never, ever took that. So it's yet to be fulfilled, see? So what we have here then is very interesting, because when you come to Daniel 11 verse 40, the king of the north of the latter days has to be what? A foreign occupier of the territory of the Seleucid kingdom. That's the green bit, all right? The green part of this map is the Seleucid kingdom. Well, it just happens to be precisely the area of the residue, which the fourth empire never took in its history. It almost is exactly the same as that map that we saw of Ezekiel 38, verse 5. Right? So there are three passages that all speak of the same thing. Which is why when the Russians came into Syria in October 2015, there was a great deal of rejoicing in my house. My wife used to go around saying she was bubbly. You know, she's so joyful that Russia was now in Syria, because she could see that this is going to come to pass in due time. Do you think the Russians are going to leave Syria? No. They have an agreement to control Latakia for 25 years with another 49 years on top of that. They built the port of Tartus. They're not going to run away from that. That was all Russian money. They now have an agreement from the Syrian government, not that that matters too much, because Putin will just march in. Because it says in this prophecy of Daniel 7, verse 7, that they stamp the residue with the feet of it. That means troops on the ground. All right. That means they're going to take it by military force, put their own rulers in power in those countries. So what we have then is the Seleucid kingdom, which becomes, when Russia takes control of it right over here to the Indus River, they become the king of the north. I don't need to tell you, but not only is Russia in Syria, they are dabbling in Iraq. They've got an alliance with Iran. Did you know that 3 weeks ago they got an agreement from the Iranian government to have two ports in the Persian Gulf and an airfield to support those ports? That's already agreed between the Russians and the Iranians. And the events that we're seeing with the Iranians foolishly, of course, reacting to the US and taking over ships and so on in the Persian Gulf is bringing all of this. You know, the Russians are saying, well, we've got to have a presence here too. If the US and Britain and other countries are going to be, we've got to be here too. See where that's heading, can't you? and the time will come. Did you know that in April last year, Vladimir Putin said that if the Taliban gain more than 40% control of Afghanistan, which they now have, Russia is going back in? All right? Did you know that Trump said to the Pakistanis, because you appear to be supporting the Taliban privately, secretly, all right, surreptitiously, no more funding, no more military aid. Guess what the first phone call was that the Prime Minister of Pakistan received from a man called Vladimir Putin and said, we'll provide you some arms, see? He's in there. He's already in there. But he's going to take it by force. And then he becomes the King of the North. And when he's the King of the North, he can fulfill Daniel chapter 11, 40, part B, which is, the King of the North shall come against him, the occupier of Constantinople. And when he's got that, he's got the base of the eastern leg of the image, then he can make his advance, as we read in the balance of Daniel chapter 11, down the coastal strip of Israel and into Egypt. Right? So you can see how relevant this is to the times in which we live. There's something to get excited about there, in my view, because we can see this as coming to pass before our very eyes. So has this been understood in the community? Well, not well, but there was one brother who understood it. His name was Maurice Stewart. All right? Brother Maurice Stewart. This is what he wrote in the North American version of his study notes on the prophecy of Daniel. You won't find this in the Australian version. All right, it was taken out of the Australian version when it was reprinted. You'll find this in the North American version. So, North Americans understand this. All right? And this is what he said. Let us emphasize, here is an important statement. This is about stamping the residue of Daniel 7:7 that has not as yet been fulfilled. Rome has never trampled the residue of Persia underfoot. It has never occupied all of this territory. He's quite right. A power must yet arise which will occupy the territories of Babylon, Persia, Greece and Rome to be afterwards subjected to a higher power, namely Jesus Christ. And then he says, Russia will do this. So it's Russia that's going to actually fulfill this prophecy because they're going to be rebuilding the fourth empire, aren't they? All right? They're the ones who are going to rebuild this fourth empire. Empire again. And they're going to put together a confederacy of all of the territories of the four empires. Thus, like the image of Daniel chapter 2, whose metals will have to be confederated together before they can be broken to pieces together, as we saw today, so also this terrible fourth beast vision has a latter day application. I'm very thankful that Brother Maurice Stewart saw that very clearly because it opened my eyes. And you can see those three passages, Ezekiel 38 verse 5, Daniel 7 verse 7, Daniel 11 verse 40 part B, all say exactly the same thing. So let's come then to the end of Daniel, to verses 41 onwards. So when Gog has control of the Seleucid territory, becomes the king of the north, then takes Constantinople, uses it as a base to sweep down through Turkey, down the coastal strip of Israel. This is the record, verse 41. He shall enter also into the glorious land. Now, the glorious land is Israel. And many countries, the word countries is not in the text, many shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. Now, context here, of course, demands that we're talking about territory, right? These powers mentioned here are mentioned because it's actually about their territories. You have Ammon, Moab and Edom, okay? So what happens, of course, is that we're going to read that he comes with many ships, but he also comes down the coastal strip of the land of Israel, could pass through Syria, of course, could be in Syria. He has a port in Latakia and Tartus, so they're not far north. They pass down here, which means, of course, that probably the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, will take refuge on the mountains of Israel, okay, and let them pass down. It'll be a good thing because Tel Aviv will be trampled underfoot in that process. And then They come down. Their main aim here is Egypt, isn't it? But their main aim is Egypt, because Napoleon said, "If he who controls Egypt rules the world," and they understand that. Now it's the centre, it's the hub of three continents, isn't it? The African, the European, and the Asian continent. This is the centre of the world, so to speak. So that's their main aim. So we read on, and it says this. By the way, you know, because they come down here, these nations escape, don't they? They escape any consequences at this point of the Gogian invasion. Go on to verse 42. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans, and the Ethiopians, or the Sudanites, because that's a reference, it's Cush, okay? It's a reference to modern Sudan, and there are problems there at the moment, and Russia's got their finger in there as well, okay? So the Libyans, they've got their finger in Libya too, aren't they? They're supporting the guy that, the dominant guy on the east of Libya, who's now attacked the capital. So, yeah, they're there as well. They're working away. It goes on to say, the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Tidings out of the east, we believe, is the movement of Christ and the saints in dealing with the Sinaitic Arabs that we spoke about today. Tidings out of the north is the activity of the Tarshish powers and those who oppose this invasion coming in to support Israel, or apparently to support Israel. And they will come in mainly from the Persian Gulf area because Russia will have control. They'll have a beachhead down the coastal strip of Palestine, or Israel as it's called. Goes on to say this, tidings out of the east and the north shall trouble him, therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and to utterly make away many. So main Russian force is brought back, of course, from Egypt. So here we've got tidings out of the east, the activity of Christ and the saints amongst the Sinaitic Arabs, and they're preparing these Arab peoples, these people who live in this area, for the Jews who will ultimately flee from this Gogian invasion. Some of them might already be fleeing because, of course, Gog is down the coastal strip of their land. The Tarshish powers will come in from mainly from the east. We do read in Psalm 48, by the way, that the ships of Tarshish will be destroyed with an east wind. An east wind? Yeah, it came from Syria and Assyria. Okay, so it looks like the Russians will have victory in the Mediterranean as well, and they will do the British Navy in, good and proper. So that's why they've got to come in here from the east. And the Egyptians are given into the hand of a cruel lord, he's described in Isaiah 19 and verse 4. And so we've got the developments that lead ultimately to Armageddon when Gog is destroyed. And that's the subject of verse 45. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. Now, that's about all I'm going to say on Daniel chapter 11. But this is part of one complete context, okay? This is the message of the angel. So it's probably fitting that we just have a brief look at what follows. And what follows is really something that's very important to you and me. Because, you see, we're going to be with Christ to deal with Gog. So what we have in chapter 12 is a reference to what happens to bring us to that position. So in Daniel 12, verses 1 and 2, we read, and at that time, so this is the time when the Gogian forces are gathering, etc., shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time, and at that time thy people shall be delivered, everyone that shall be found written in the book. So the thy people here is not Israel. It's those whose names are in the book of life. This is a reference to our salvation. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth, so here's your resurrection, shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Okay, so what we have here is two concomitant events. They happen at the same time. The resurrection of the dead, which of course also means our removal to the judgment seat, is the beginning of the time of trouble, such as never was. This is why, of course, we talk about the great the Great Depression that's coming, when the world's economy collapses, when, you know, banks collapse and all sorts of things collapse, and men go into into panic And there will be a time that they've never experienced before at the time of the end. So these are the two concomitant events. Michael, of course, here we believe is a reference to Christ, the one who was like ale. He took over Michael's role when he arrived at the right hand of the Father. And he's here to raise the dead. He's also here for the judgment seat, which follows in verses 2 and 3. And verse 3 talks about the wonderful future of those. It says in verse 3, and they that be wise, in actual fact it should be rendered, and they who make wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. So the resurrection era is the period when the time of trouble begins. When you come to verse 4 of Daniel 12, you read this. And this is why I'm dealing with this. This is a school of the prophets. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book. It says even, it should read until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Now, we tend to use this passage, don't we, about the modern world in which, you know, men are running to and fro. It's marvellous. And Mark and I, God willing, will go to Israel. We'll probably not be able to walk in the streets with the number of Christadelphians that are there. You know, so we're actually running to and fro, aren't we? But that's not what this means, okay? That's not what it's about. There's a much deeper meaning. Jesenius says the word shoot, to run to and fro, is used metaphorically to run through a book, all right? That is to examine thoroughly. This is exactly what the school of prophets is about, isn't it? Understanding the prophecies of the word of God. And we are very, very blessed to have had brethren like Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts and others who followed them, who have laid out before us the prophetic framework of the scriptures that allow us to have a complete, almost a complete picture of what is happening around us and what will happen in the future. It is a marvellous blessing, but you don't get that blessing unless you're prepared to put your head in the book. You've got to be running, as it were, to and fro through the book in order to get this knowledge and understanding, to examine it thoroughly. Brother Mansfield comments in the Expositor on this. He said, it's nevertheless true also that the scriptures have been opened up to a greater extent than formerly. Printed expositions and commentaries abound, and the passage of history has verified most prophetic details. Yet, he says, there is still a lack of true understanding, and we can address that by going away from such events as this and making sure that we put our heads in the book and make those progressive, incremental steps of understanding. I can tell you, it takes time. All right, you don't get it all in one day. You're not going to get it all in 1 year. You won't get it in 10 years. You've actually got to put a lot of work in over time. And if you do that, God will bless it. All right, that's the message that comes from this chapter. When you come to chapter 12, verses 9 and 10, we read this. And he said to Daniel, go thy way, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. What was the time of the end? Well, our era, 1917, see? Okay. And it says, many shall be purified and made white. This is the effect of this. If you get this understanding, you can be purified and made white. And they tried. But the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand. But the wise shall understand. This word purified, barar in the Hebrew, means to purify. It's to select, to polish, to choose, to purge, to cleanse or make bright. That's the effect of understanding the word of God when you are truly dedicated to its understanding. Rotherham says of that phrase in yellow, the lawless will act lawlessly and none of the lawless shall understand. How true that is. Right. So we've got a choice, haven't we? Choice of being in one class or the other. So, brethren, as we come to the end of this day, and I think tomorrow is going to be a fresh day in the hall, God willing, we come to the end of this day, may Daniel's destiny be ours. Last verse, okay, Daniel chapter 12. But go thou thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days. And there are three stages that Daniel was shown in chapter 10. Come back to chapter 10. There were three stages that he would have to go through in order to be raised from the dead, judged worthy, and changed into an immortal being. And you're probably all familiar with this. But this is one of the great things that God did for Daniel in the last year of his life. He puts him through a typical death, resurrection, judgment, and immortalization. right, in Daniel chapter 10. So you pick this up in verse 8 of Daniel 10. Therefore, he says, I was left alone. He's just seen the vision of the man of the one, the multitudinous Christ. I saw this great vision, and there remained no strength in me, for my comeliness was turned in me into corruption, and I retained no strength. And then in verse 9, he says, yet heard I the voice of his words, and when I heard the voice of his words, then was I in a deep sleep on my face, and my face toward the ground. Now, we don't normally sleep on our face, do we? I mean, most of us sleep on our side or on our back. To sleep on your face, as it were, to fall on the ground on your face means that literally you're dead, as it were. Typically, you're dead. He dies. And then we see in verse 10, the next stage. He's reformed and given life, but he's feeble. Verse 10, and behold, a hand touched me, which set me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hands. So the angel comes to the grave, as it were, and he raises Daniel, as he will all of the dead. And by the way, my father was buried today in Australia, and I wasn't able to be at the funeral. So, you know, if you saw me being a bit somber, that's the reason for it. My dad was laid to rest today in Australia. He died at age nearly 94. So this has got great relevance to me. He said to me in verse 11, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto thee and stand upright, which is the meaning of the word anastasis. Anastasis means to stand upright, standing up of the dead ones. For unto thee am I now sent. And when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood trembling. And so the resurrected dead will be held in a state where they will not be able to make trouble. You know, they won't even be able to speak. They'll stand trembling. And when the time for their judgment comes, they'll be given sufficient strength for that process. They'll be able to speak then at the time of the interview. So this, he's strengthened and he stands up for judgment in verses 16 and 17. And behold, one like the similitude of the sons of men touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spake, like we're all going to do at the judgment seat when we talk to the angel. And then he's accepted and immortalized. And in Daniel chapter 10 and verses 18 and 19 we read, then there came again and touched me one like the appearance of a man, and he strengthened me. And he said, O man greatly beloved, fear not, peace be unto thee, be strong, yea, be strong, and you'll never be stronger than when you're immortal. So Daniel is, what a blessing that is. Think about that. Here's this man in his 90s, and he's about to die. He dies in this year, and God's not going to let him die until he sees the attainment of the decree of Cyrus that will see his people go back to the land. That's all he's living for, right? He sees the decree of Cyrus, and then God says, look, I'll just put you through a little program here to tell you what I'm going to do with you. You're going to die very shortly, but the day will come when you'll come out of the ground. You'll stand at the judgment seat, and then you'll be immortalized because you are a man greatly beloved. The wise will understand. Tomorrow, God willing, we'll have a look at the convergence of Bible prophecy in the apocalypse.